I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Chances are when you opened your morning paper today, you read about the two Palestinian boys wounded in an explosion and the latest ceasefire in Macedonia. Chances are you did not read about the 13 people shot and killed yesterday in another of the world's agonizing, drawn-out battles. The latest deaths in the tiny mountain state of Kashmir add to the more than 30,000 killed in recent years. Kashmir, in all its Himalayan beauty, rests like a blasting cap between three nuclear powers, India, Pakistan, and China. The traffic in arms, in torture, and diplomatic deceit led President Clinton to call it the most dangerous place on earth. Next week, the two nations battling over Kashmir will hold their first official summit talks in 2.5 years. Pakistan's head of state, General Pervez Musharraf, and India's Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee will meet. Though the history of broken deals and mistrust leaves many skeptical about the chances for peace. Connection listeners, could this be a beginning to the end of the war for Kashmir? What do you think it will take? And why does the rest of the world stand back at such a distance from such a dangerous confrontation? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are Ambassador Shireen Tahir-Khelli. She is Director of the South Asian Program at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. She joins us by phone from New Mexico. With me in the studio is Devesh Kapoor. He's Associate Professor of Government at Harvard. And from London, Andrew Whitehead is one of the BBC analysts for South Asia and will be heading to cover the summit when it begins next week. So, Andrew, I will begin with you because the roots of religious conflicts that we know in Northern Ireland and the Middle East, they're fairly straightforward to understand. Is it as easy to say that the conflict in Kashmir can be boiled down to a religious battle between Muslims and Hindus?
No, it can't be boiled down to something quite as simple as that, Dick. But the basic issue is that way back in 1947, when India and Pakistan got independence, Kashmir had a Hindu Maharaja, but a mainly Muslim population. And that Maharaja opted for Kashmir to become part of largely Hindu India, not of Muslim Pakistan. And the two countries have been fighting about it ever since. And having been to Kashmir, both sides of Kashmir, quite recently, certainly the mood still in the Indian part of Kashmir, which is mainly Muslim, is that most Kashmiris do not want Indian rule. And that's what all the trouble is about.
Ambassador Tahir-Khelli, I'm wondering, as you look ahead at this summit, whether or not you see any kind of new opportunity for cracking this long conflict.
I do believe that there is an opportunity. While most of us try and not get our hopes up too much because it's too many years and 2 days are not going to resolve everything, I think there is, given the strong position of both leaders in their respective countries, an opportunity to begin the process that could unravel this problem.
Why are you saying that they are in a stronger position in their own countries than leaders who have preceded them?
Well, on the Pakistani side, the answer is a simpler one. The military always does have a very important role. And one of the unfortunate happenings in the previous attempt in February 1999, when Mr. Vajpayee traveled to Lahore for the last summit between the two countries' leaders, the military was basically left out of the consultation process, and therefore you saw the results. I mean, Kargil was the undoing of Lahore. You have in place now a strong president because he comes from the military and he has been consulting with both with his colleagues and with other people. In India, you've got Mr. Vajpayee, who is the head of the BJP government, and its ability to forge an agreement and then to stick by it, I think, is greater at this time than has been the case with past governments. Although in February 1999, when Mr. Vajpayee reached out, I think it was a bold step that did not pay off. But I think on the Pakistani side, the stars are in the right place at this time.
just to fill in, after the 1999 conversation, the fighting in Kargil was what many people consider to be like the third little war being fought over Kashmir. Things are a little quieter at this time. But Devesh Kapoor, if I can bring you into the conversation now, can you turn around what the ambassador is saying and say, you know, this leader in India, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, is head of a Hindu nationalist party, perhaps less tolerant of finding some accommodation with Muslims, and the general in Pakistan leads a country which is intimately involved militarily with Kashmir. I understand what ambassador is saying about they're both strong in their own countries, but does it make it difficult for them to talk to each other?
Well, to a considerable sort of extent, the fact that Vajpayee, who after the coup sort of refused to talk to Musharraf and the government of India, largely because of a sense of betrayal following
the
incidents at Kargil, and also the fact that Musharraf was clearly sort of involved. But I think he has realized, and the government of India has realized, that they have no option. I mean, the military is the center of power in Pakistan, and also there is no end to sight to the problems in Kashmir. And you have, you know, even if they think that Pakistan is behind it all, you have to talk with the enemy. You don't, you know, if you to solve a problem insofar as they think that Pakistan is the enemy. But also, I think there is a sense also now that Musharraf has like consolidated his position. I mean, I think one of the things is after a coup, you aren't really sure that, look,
who's really in charge.
Yeah. Exactly. And so if you do like sit down and come to any agreement, given the lack of constitutional status in Pakistan, whether it would be followed through. But now there is a general sense in India that, you know, you like it or not, you have to talk with Musharraf.
Andrew Whitehead, I'm interested in knowing how much more complicated this issue is now after 1998, when we learned that both countries have nuclear capabilities. How much harder is it then to try and reconcile the differing points of view over Kashmir?
I don't think it's made any difference to reconciling over Kashmir, but I think what has happened following the nuclear tests that both countries conducted back in 1998 is that the Americans have come in a very big way. And I think American diplomacy, often quite discreet diplomacy, has been pushing the two countries towards talking. We saw President Clinton going to India and then very briefly to Pakistan last year. And it's quite clear that the new administration is following through. And certainly quite a few people are telling me that the Americans have been key players in bringing the two sides together. So I think the awful specter of a potential nuclear conflict with Kashmir as the trigger has prompted the United States in particular to give South Asia higher diplomatic priority.
The discreet type of diplomacy that you're talking about, is that because neither of the countries would tolerate the Americans telling them what to do, and so really the only way they can do it is behind the scenes?
Well, it's certainly partly that, but in India in particular, there is strong opposition to the idea of international mediation on the Kashmir issue. So, I mean, when British ministers have in the past suggested that Britain's always ready and willing, if required, to step in as a mediator over Kashmir, they've been struck down fairly viciously by the Indian government. India basically says that whatever issue there is to settle must be settled either internally by talks between the government and Kashmiris on the Indian side, or bilaterally between Delhi and Islamabad. But there's absolutely no doubt that the continuous prodding of American diplomacy and the feeling in Delhi, for the first time in many years, that Delhi and Washington are on the same wavelength, really is making quite a difference. And the Americans are being much more effective diplomatically in South Asia than they have been for many years.
Ambassador, this is something that you have been involved with on the inside and on the outside. Do you see the American involvement this time as having a significant impact on this particular summit?
Well, I agree with what's just been said. It's wonderful to hear about American diplomacy as being discreet. I think that's not an adjective that often applies to us. So I'm pleased to hear that. But I think that the Indian dislike of American mediation is there, but the U.S. is not offered any mediation as such. Encouragement of a process for the two countries to reach out to each other, I think, has been there behind the scenes. It's in part a result of a calculation whereby Washington, I think, believes that the current situation, or the situation at least in the last 2 years of zero official level contact, a history of warfare, a long border, some of which is a potential flashpoint, nuclear weapons capabilities, all make for a potential disaster. And I think all friends of South Asia, and the United States certainly is one of them, have encouraged both countries to go forward and get beyond the suspicion and try and re-engage. I think what's different also at this point is the Indian, as was just mentioned, the comfort level with Washington, and the third party allergy is sort of being downgraded, and also the Indian desire to get beyond this issue, to play the kind of regional global role that India and Mr. Vajpayee have been seeking to play, and is more made more difficult by the constant problems of Pakistan. On the Pakistani side, the economic problems, the desire to get back into a more positive image and basically to sort of pick up pieces of a Pakistan that's been spiraling downwards have made it also necessary for Pakistan to reach out. And historically, if one looks back, it is a very quiet American encouragement of confidence-building measures between these two countries, going way back certainly to the early 80s, that have traditionally moved both. So it's both the encouragement from the United States plus the, I think, the domestic situations and the regional situations vis-a-vis each country.
But it becomes that much more complicated, Devesh Kapoor, because you've got Afghanistan now involved and China watching the whole thing and wondering how whatever happens in Kashmir will alter, how it will alter its relationship with the United States.
Absolutely. I just wanted to sort of revisit a point made by Shireen about the strengths of the two leaders, which sort of drove this this summit. But I think it's also the weaknesses, which also helped to drive certain changes in attitudes. And in the case of India, of course, it's been playing the weak card in Kashmir. It's quite obvious, right? I mean, given that it has a mess on its hands. But I think what has changed in the past few years for Pakistan is its economy is clearly under a collapse. But more than that, it really needs the IMF to help it out. And of course, it's the U.S. which controls the loans. And this leverage has allowed the U.S. to prod Pakistan to at least be less or at least be a little more open to the idea of negotiations. And plus, as both Andrew and Shireen have said, that, you know, the fact that the U.S. Third-party like mediation, because of the links between U.S. and Pakistan because of the Cold War, India was always sort of skeptical that would be, quote, a neutral party. But now it's very clear, as recent statements have and sort of relationships between the two countries have changed, that that the U.S. will at least be seen by India as, if not pro its interests, but at least neutral.
Connection listeners, the summit between India and Pakistan coming up late next week. Is this, could it be a beginning to the end of the war for Kashmir? We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. We're talking about the upcoming summit between the Indians and the Pakistanis to discuss principally the issue of Kashmir. My guests this hour, Devesh Kapoor, he's Associate Professor of Government at Harvard University, Ambassador Shireen Tahir-Kelly, she's Director of the South Asia Program at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Andrew Whitehead, former BBC correspondent in India, currently a BBC South Asian analyst. Andrew, I understand that you were in Kashmir 2 or 3 months ago, and I was thinking as we went to our break, that we're talking about all these forces sort of peering over the borders and not talking about the people who actually live there. What was it like when you were last there? Are the people who live there absolutely fed up, ready for any solution? What was it like?
Not ready for any solution, but you're right. The Kashmiris do feel fed up. They do feel overlooked. They do feel very acutely that they're caught in the middle between India and Pakistan, who they, from the Kashmiri point of view, they regard as playing power diplomacy, but forgetting the interests of the people on the ground. What I found a little bit depressing is that there have been quite hopeful signs over the past few months. The line of control, the ceasefire line between Indian and Pakistani troops in Kashmir has been quiet for several months. There was also for a while a ceasefire between the Indian security forces and the Kashmiri separatist militants, the armed militants inside Indian Kashmir, though that wasn't anything like as effective. But in spite of those moderately hopeful signs and attempts by India to establish dialogue with Kashmiri political leaders, the mood there was nothing's going to change. We're fed up with the violence, but we see no hope. And particularly worrying, I thought, was that ordinary Kashmiris in Srinagar or Sopore or Baramulla, there was no Kashmiri leader in whom they had confidence. Not any of the separatist leaders, not the chief minister, who was a Kashmiri Muslim but pro-India, nobody in whom they had confidence. They just thought they were trapped. They've gone through 12 years of a very high level of violence. I mean, even in the last few months, at least twice the number killed as have been killed in the Intifada in the Middle East, and they can see no way out.
Is it their conclusion that nothing will happen without intervention then?
I certainly think they would like the world to pay more attention to Kashmir, and there's a real feeling there is, why does the world ignore us? Why does the United States and Britain and Western Europe not throw more of a spotlight on Kashmir? Why isn't it the focus of international diplomacy in the way that the Middle East and the Balkans are? But talking to people on the Indian side of Kashmir, which is the Kashmir Valley, which is the heart of Kashmir, I have little doubt that if people were given the choice, they would opt not for India or Pakistan, but for independence. And that, I think, is the option that neither India nor Pakistan will ever allow them to have.
Devesh Kapoor, you work teaching in Harvard. You must address this issue on a more regular basis. Why is it that people are not engaged in Kashmir? Why don't they see it as something which, if the world would turn its attention to it, perhaps something could be, peace could be found at a speedier pace?
Well, one, because it's such a sort of unholy mess. You know, no one wants to be involved with issues that are extremely intractable, and I think one should have no doubts. There is also, I think, the fact. Well, one is, you know, it's a bit like Tibet, right? If you have a large power involved, in this case, India, Tibet's case, China, outside powers are much more wary because they have
the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama have done a better job of putting their cause before the world than the Kashmiris, though, wouldn't you say?
Well, the big difference is violence, right? And the bigger difference between the two is that the Tibetan struggle is indigenous, whereas in the case of Kashmir, what began as a nationalist struggle has become the sort of joker in the pack has been the religious element, which has come in from Afghanistan, from the madrasas in Pakistan, and that has really queered the pitch, and which makes outside powers much more wary because, as you well know, the Taliban don't exactly have too many friends. So if it's people they are training, then it doesn't really excite too much sympathy.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join the conversation about the future of Kashmir. And Nasser is on the line. Hello, Nasser, go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Okay. Recently, I attended a conference at Harvard Law School on Kashmir issue. There were several factions of leaders, student leaders, and different party leaders from both India and Pakistani side and from the Kashmiri side, both sides. They were sick and tired of the violence, and they were ready to make peace. They were telling different types of stories, what has happened for the last 50 years. Looks like people are starting to get ready for certain type of peace. The other point I want to make is this. I have spoken to James Baker, Secretary of State, and George Mitchell. James Baker was very concerned, obviously, about the probability of having some kind of nuclear war between India and Pakistan. And I think that's a little bit far-reaching. I don't think it's going to happen, even though there are so much animosity between the two. But the basic point is, when I spoke to George Mitchell and I asked him personally that what was the probability of him volunteering between India and Pakistan because it's such a enormous issue, what he has done in Ireland. And at that point, that was a couple of years ago, he mentioned to me that he just had a young family and he didn't have much time to volunteer. So, but I think he's the guy. And I would like to ask Andrew that what does he think, getting since I it appears that the Western nations are paying some attention to that that problem right now, that he should be prodded. And will he volunteer, or will he be acceptable to both India and Pakistan?
I think let's let Andrew in on that, Nasser. Let's let Andrew answer that.
Well, let me start with that last point of your question, Nasser. Will George Mitchell be acceptable to India and Pakistan? And the answer, I'm afraid, is no. Pakistan would love to have somebody like George Mitchell acting as a mediator, but India simply wouldn't wear it. There's just no way they would. And you can't impose a mediator. And after all, George Mitchell has performed not far short of miracles in Northern Ireland, but the situation there remains very difficult. And that's with the goodwill of people on both sides. Kashmir, we're not that far advanced. I think, although a lot is hoped for from the Agra summit, the one thing that you won't see emerging is a blueprint to sort out the Kashmir issue. It's just too complicated, and the stands of the two countries are so divergent. I mean, shared sovereignty doesn't seem to be an option, and they're both claiming the same patch of ground. They can't both have it.
Ambassador, I'm wondering if the kind of conversation that Nasser describes taking place, is that even going on in India and Pakistan at this point?
Well, the conversations are actually not even going on very much, even within each country, in terms of a solution to the Kashmir problem. There are bits and pieces of solutions that come up from time to time. I think what's more likely is the launching of a procedure towards discussion of the issues, and maybe the appointment of special emissaries from each country. Even if we see the appointment of an international emissary to help with the resolution of this conflict, that emissary will still have to sell it to each government and to the Kashmiris. So if one starts at the other end of the process, and that is that each leader picks a particular person who continues this dialogue, not on an on-again, off-again basis, but at least with some continuity over the next several months, maybe they can start to define, refine their positions to find at least some common ground. As Andrew said, it's one patch of land and they both claim it, they both can't have it. But are there other more creative ways in which they can maybe put off the ultimate sort of solution to this conflict, but in the meantime make the lives of the Kashmiris a little bit better and stop the violence and the bloodshed? It seems to me that at least that one ought to expect from the two leaders.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Rick is on the line. Rick, go ahead.
Good morning. I want to clearly state my bias. I'm from India, and I was would just like to give a reflection of the Indian point of view. Ever since Kargil, I was very moderate on this issue before, but now I believe that there is a, especially I have some friends in the Indian military, and we've seen a lot of resentment in India per se, a lot of feeling of hurt after Kargil, and I don't believe that what your callers have been, what your hosts have been saying, that the Indian leader is strong enough to be able to make a compromise with Pakistan at this stage, because India is a democracy and the government right now has a very few seats in majority, and they will not be able to take a bold position, because I don't think the general Indian populace is right now has gotten over the feeling. of Kargil, and there's just a feeling that, you know, this is a neighbor that we'd have to be strong with rather than have a party that we can negotiate with and come to long-term peace with. That is, I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but this is...
I think I share some of your sentiments, but I think the basic weakness of the Vajpayee government is not that it has a very small majority. In fact, that can be a source of strength. His main weakness is his own party, and that elements in the BJP itself are the most sort of hard line on compromises with Pakistan. And in fact, I would imagine that the opposition would, by and large, go along with a sort of compromise insofar as he goes. But I do think that the popular sentiment in India after Kargil, you're absolutely right, is one of extreme distrust. And in any democracy, leader is unlikely to go too far out of step with popular sentiment. And so I don't think so one could expect bigger breakthroughs, but insofar as this leads to more confidence-building measures and really sort of rebuilding of trust, which has been, basically there's been absolutely no trust. That itself would be a major achievement of the summit.
Andrew Whitehead, General Pervez Musharraf, 2 weeks ago dismissed the Pakistani president, thereby wrapping himself in the mantle of the head of state of Pakistan. There was some question about that. Does he go to this summit with his Indian counterpart with any more clout as a result of doing that, or can he persuade the Indians that what he says his country will stick to?
I don't think it gives him much greater authority. I know that Washington and West European capitals got really quite excited about General Musharraf declaring himself president, but I think the view in Delhi was that Musharraf was already in charge, and what he wants to call himself, it doesn't really matter. I suppose the one thing that does make a difference in is that General Musharraf is making quite clear that he will have a very prominent role in the government of Pakistan beyond the elections, which he's promised towards the end of next year. And I suppose that gives him a little bit more authority. But I think the important point is one that Shireen made earlier. With General Musharraf on one side, a military guy, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee, a Hindu nationalist prime minister, on the other, you've got two leaders meeting in Agra who cannot easily be outflanked by hardline nationalists at home. And that gives them just a little bit more political flexibility. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are quite optimistic about the summit. And I think the other one, which is even more important, is that both General Musharraf and Mr. Vajpayee appear to have a very strong personal commitment to turning the corner and to finding a way of superseding the mistrust of the past and building a new friendship.
Ambassador Tahir Kelly, I'm wondering if they meet and if they are unable to get anything to agree on, is that trouble, more trouble for Kashmir?
My own sense is that they are not meeting with the expectation that they're going to resolve Kashmir. And it's.
But they need to show some progress, some goodwill, right?
They cannot afford really to fail completely. Because each has taken a bold step in first the invitation and then the acceptance of the invitation. So we will see some decline in the tensions. They will probably start the journey towards some solution in Kashmir. They may find some interim measures that make the lives of ordinary Indians and Pakistanis easier, such as visas, consulates, those kinds of things. I think they will try and address something on the nuclear risk reduction side. This is an issue that has a lot of importance to the rest of the world, but it also has importance for the two countries. And it's a dangerous situation whether or not, as one of your callers said, they will go to nuclear war. The point is not to wait until they go to nuclear war, but to undertake procedures that prevent nuclear escalation. So I think they might go for something like that, and a reiteration of the need for dialogue and engagement after the kind of freeze that we have seen in the last 2 years.
Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Saib is calling us from Buffalo, New York. Saib, do you want to go ahead?
Yes. My point is that the issue is not very complicated. Kashmir issue has been on the United Nations since 1948. There are several UN resolutions specifying how to solve the problem. Now, you consistently report Indian point of view, which is basically false. The UN resolutions clearly specify that the will of the people should determine the future of Kashmir. So there is no reason to justify and predict and complicate the issue by saying it is very difficult and so forth. And then number two is that there should be no propagandizing the situation. 80,000 Kashmiris have been killed by Indian army, and they should be clearly cleared. I mean, we should find out somewhere. And I believe the whole reason the Western governments, the Western press, and the UN is not interested in Kashmir is because Kashmiris are Muslims, and you have an anti-Muslim bias. Now, the man from Harvard claimed that this is Taliban. He ought to know the Taliban just came out 3 years ago. Kashmir issue has been there for 50 years. So you should not use this kind of propagandizing, the methodology to justify genocide of Kashmiri people. And you do not allow Kashmiris to speak on these forums.
Are you yourself from Kashmir?
Yes, I'm from Kashmir. I've been there. I've lived in the United States for 30 years. And I think it's shameful for both the BBC correspondent to predict Kashmiris are tired. Yes, they are tired of genocide. They're tired of silence of the Western media and the Western governments, but they're not going to give up their right. Will you give up your right to be a free people? No. Nobody will, and they will eventually make India bow.
Okay, just
the prediction that India, we are so strong and tough, this is a starving country.
Saab, I want you to stay on the line, but I want to let some of my guests have a chance to weigh in here, and perhaps you can stay with us. Really brief point from you, if I could, Mr. Kapoor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if the West really had anti-Muslim bias only, then I should remind the caller that in 1971, the carnage inflicted by Pakistan on what was then East Pakistan, that cost the life of more than a million Muslims. In fact, the U.S. was, if anything, was the Nixon doctrine was then to support Pakistan because of its interests vis-a-vis China. So I think if one is talking of carnage and of millions of Muslims being killed, there are precedents in the past where one gets exactly the opposite.
This is something that we will continue after our break, so please stay with us. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Connection listeners, the summit that's coming up late next week between India and Pakistan to discuss the issue in Kashmir, what do you think it'll take? And why does the rest of the world stand back and pay so little attention to this blasting cap? You're listening to The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour we're discussing the upcoming summit between India and Pakistan and what the ramifications of that could be. Just before we went to our break, our caller, a Kashmiri Saab, made the point, Andrew Whitehead, when Western journalists like you cover this, you focus too much on what India thinks, what Pakistan thinks, and not enough on the self-determination of the Kashmiris. Does he make a good point?
Well, it's a point that we often hear. I don't think it's a point that I would accept. Journalists based in Delhi and in Islamabad go as much as they possibly can to Kashmir to report on what's happening on the ground, to give weight to the views of the Kashmiri political leaders who you don't hear very much from in Delhi and Islamabad. But I understand the deep sense of grievance that Saib and many other Kashmiris feel about what's happening there. There is a strong sense of grievance in Kashmir. But the thing that I would say in response to what Saib has said in his call is that you cannot try to solve the Kashmir problem in 2001 simply by reference to United Nations resolutions passed in 1948. They are, in a sense, history. And simply waving them around and saying, why doesn't the world do something, isn't good enough. You've got to start with the situation as it is today.
We're joined on the line now by Mohammed. Mohammed, would you like to go ahead? You're on The Connection.
Hello.
Hi, Mohammed. Please go ahead.
No, this is Mahesh.
Oh, Mahesh. Okay.
I'm from India, and I watched the situation for almost 50 years, and it's a complex issue. Because Kashmir is not just Muslims. It's one part is Muslim, one part is Hindu and Sikhs, and other part is Buddhists, and makes the situation complex. Hindus and Buddhists don't want to join Pakistan, and they don't want even independence. And only a part of Muslim Kashmiris want independence. rest of them would rather stay with India. And so India is in a tough position, and Pakistan is in a tough position because there are a lot of extremist Muslims who will not accept any solution.
We've covered a lot of this ground before. What do you think is the way out?
Way out is to develop friendship through trade and relations, and your status quo is probably the best solution if Pakistan accepts this. There's no other way out of this mess.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of trade, because when those two leaders meet in India next week, the Pakistanis are saying all we want to talk about is Kashmir. India is saying there's a lot more to talk about. Devesh Kapoor, can trade lead to any kind of solution that we're not talking about at that point? Are there incremental ways of resolving the ill will here?
Well, I mean, you know, two countries which are neighbors and have such a pitiful trade sort of relationships, it's a sort of indictment of the quality of the relationship. For Pakistan, the argument has been that, look, if it gets into broader engagement with India, it will reduce the pressure on India to deal with Kashmir. And so it basically, the argument is that, look, settle Kashmir and everything else will follow. Everything else. It's the key that will open all the doors. For India, it is that, look, you know, we need a broad-based dialogue on a variety of issues, of which Kashmir would be one of them, but not the sole issue. And that, I think, is something which would be interesting to see how it plays itself out in the summit. I would imagine that if you had much stronger trade relationships, at least over the medium run, it would be economically beneficial for the two countries, for sure. And of course, it would lead to much broader sort of engagement sort of at the people-to-people level as businessmen travel. And of course, money itself creates new interests, and that's not unimportant.
Go ahead, Ambassador.
Something to what has just been said.
Yes.
You know, the trade is of course you know, the cement that can bind the future relationship. Current trade is 100 million at the legal levels. Illegal through either smuggling or via third country, usually Dubai, is nearly 2 billion. So there is a need for some trade, and actually, as often happens, some of it is taking place. The question is how to channel it officially and use that productively. But the fact is that some of what we are just saying is a little bit redundant, because both governments have now said that they recognize that this issue of Kashmir, which has bedeviled the relationship, needs to be and will be addressed. So that much at least has occurred. I have spent the last 20 years of my life very actively looking for those other issues that can help build the relationship and create a stake. I've come to the conclusion at this point that in some fashion, whatever that resolution undefined at this point is, India and Pakistan do need to get officially into a discussion of the Kashmir issue and find that either the timetable that they can agree on to actually resolve it, or at least to begin the process. Without that, the talks will not go very far. There is already, as of 1998, in the Foreign Secretary's talks, a formula that provides for 8 different sets of issues to be discussed, peace and security being one of them. So, I mean, there are various options available to the two leaders to pick up the threads and move on with some discussion of Kashmir and some discussion of other issues. And I don't think it's an either-or situation at this point.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And Prelip is on the line. Prelip, you're on The Connection.
Good morning. It's Pradeep from Brookline. The point I want to make is that in the early part of the program, there was a lot of talk and emphasis on the Western role in terms of playing a mediator role. Given the track record that the Western world has, whether it's the U.S., the U.K., or Russia, there's very little credibility that they have. In fact,
Philippe, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm sorry, not because I don't want you to make your point, but I'm having so much difficulty hearing you over the crackle on the line. I'm going to take a stab here that your point is that there has been too much emphasis on Western mediation. Andrew, you and I both know from having been based in Delhi that there are South Asian governmental organizations and others who could be involved. is the West key to cracking the Kashmir puzzle?
No, I think that the Kashmir issue has got to be settled by people in the region, and that's principally India and Pakistan. But with the Kashmiris themselves, I would hope and expect having a big say as well. And one of the main thrusts of Western diplomacy has not been trying to mediate, trying to get in the middle of India and Pakistan, but encouraging journalists, academics, intellectuals from the two countries to meet. And they've been very successful at that. There's been an annual gathering at a place called Neemrana, not just far out of Delhi, which has brought together people who wouldn't normally meet because travel between India and Pakistan is not far off impossible for many nationals of those two countries. And that, I think, is where Western diplomacy has reaped some sort of dividend. There are now quite a lot of people in India and Pakistan who can pick up the phone and talk to people they regard as friends in the other country, because they've met at one of these get-togethers organized by a Western embassy. But in terms of a direct Western governmental role, no. I think it's India and Pakistan and the Kashmiris who've got to do the talking.
I want to ask all three of you, all three of my guests, if you can help me with one aspect of this, because it goes to the heart of the question that we're asking about why we should pay attention. If you want to read the most pessimistic accounts of the future of that part of the world, you'll read about how the military in Pakistan is captive of its Islamic leaders, that the links between Osama bin Laden and Pakistan will grow stronger rather than weaker, and that as India and China square off over Kashmir, each one's finger gets closer to the nuclear button. Do we do this whole issue a disservice, Ambassador, by saying, oh gosh, these countries have nuclear weapons, or must we really look at it that way?
I think that the overt nuclearization of India and Pakistan is not something that anybody can ignore. The fact is that, in a sense, their nuclear status makes it more difficult to allow, in terms of world opinion, to contemplate changing of international borders through the use of or threat of nuclear weapons. And that's part of, I think, why what happened with Kargil and the terrible beating that Pakistan took in international public opinion. But the fact is, it is a part of the world which has had for 50 plus years very poor relations. India and Pakistan, whenever they have been mentioned in terms of each other, it's usually been the years of conflict or the particular specific situation of war or near war. And when the world ignores that aspect, then it is accused of looking away, as some of the callers have said, that, you know, Kashmiris die every day and nobody cares. It isn't that nobody cares. I think it's more that given the politics of the region, the status of each country, the dislike for international involvement, at least on the part of India, it makes it extremely difficult. And there isn't a simple solution. And even India and Pakistan have moved to a variety of solutions since 1948. They've agreed to the similar accord, which put it not only in the UN context, but in the bilateral context. So the mix is not only volatile, it's terribly complicated, as I think that the other two speakers have pointed out.
Let Devesh in on this, Ambassador. Do we need to give ourselves a wake-up call and keep reminding ourselves about how dangerous this could all become by not paying attention to what's going on?
I think we do need to pay attention. I can speak a little bit about the United States. The United States has paid attention sometime in a very, quite frustrated as a result of it.
Ambassador, I'm going to let the others in here. I have to keep an eye on the clock, and I'd like everyone to have a concluding statement. Devesh, could you speak briefly about that?
I mean, I think, first of all, we should be really concerned because it involves the suffering of people. I mean,
right now.
Right now. I mean, insofar as the welfare of Kashmiris is involved, and very clearly they have been suffering a lot for the past decade, that we should be concerned largely because of any group that is suffering, we should be concerned about it. Purely on humanitarian grounds, Right. But the broader issue which you raise is the broader security ramifications is, I think, I mean, one argument which is made is that, look, if the Kashmir issue is not resolved to a degree which the moderates, say, within Pakistan, especially in the Pakistani army, can sell it more broadly, then there's a fear that it might embolden the hardliners both within the army and outside, and it might further Pakistan's drift into a more hardline Islamic state. And so the Kashmir, and that might then lead to the sorts of security problems which you alluded to. Now, that is a question which is very hard to address, whether indeed that would happen or if. But any time you have a sense of drift, it's always a problem.
Andrew Whitehead with the BBC. I read something recently written by a former colleague of yours, Humphrey Hawksley, who was talking about a walk through Pakistan and discussions with people there and how everybody was saying, you know, if we have to use the nuclear weapon, we'll use the nuclear weapon. And I, the colors are drained from my face as I read this. I'm wondering how you view this in the nuclear context as you get ready to go off and cover the summit.
Well, the rhetoric is very intense, but to put it simply, India and Pakistan have a shared history, a shared culture, to a large degree a common language, yet there are no direct flights between the two capitals. There's next to no legal trade. That you can't see Indian films in Pakistani cinemas, you can't buy Pakistani papers on Indian bookstalls, there's been no dialogue for 2 years at all, there's no real prospect of regional cooperation, and both countries are spending money that they cannot afford on a regional and a nuclear arms race. And the basic core problem is Kashmir, and it does need to be addressed.
I want to thank all three of you for joining me in this conversation today. My guests have been Ambassador Shirin Tahir Kelly, Director of the South Asia Program at Johns Hopkins University. Andrew Whitehead is a former BBC correspondent based in India. He's currently an analyst with a South Asian analyst with BBC. And Devesh Kapoor is Associate Professor of Government at Harvard University. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.